back together again, you and I. Yes, brand new week, Monday, November 7th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. We featured a chat with University of New Haven Associate Professor of Political Science Chris Haynes on Tuesday's elections coming up, and I had some thoughts on the Democrats' self-inflicted mistakes that could cost them. American Commitment President Phil Kirpin joined the show to talk about federal court challenges to President Biden's proposed student loan forgiveness plan.
Well, in case you didn't know, there's an election tomorrow, several of them on the state legislative level and federal and national. As well, our next guest is an associate professor of political science and legal studies at the University of New Haven. He's an expert on public opinion, voting, immigration, and he is co-author of the book Framing Immigrants, News Coverage, Public Opinion, and Policy. And he also co-authored, we'll talk about this, The Twitter Effect, How Trump Used Social Media to Stamp His Brand and Shape the Media Narrative on Immigration. And the guest is Dr. Chris Haynes of the University of New Haven. Dr. Haynes, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Glad to be here.
Is this whole thing finally going to end tomorrow, Chris? Because every depending upon where the commercial's coming from, Chris, I've figured out, and tell me if I'm right on this, every candidate's either Satan or the second coming of Jesus or something in between. I'm not sure.
We can only hope that it's going to come to an end at some point. It really is a reflection of the deep divide that we have in society today in terms of how stark the contrast is and how everyone thinks the sky's going to fall if the other party comes into power. There are very important issues. I don't want to trivialize it in any way at stake here. But we have these elections every 2 years on the congressional level. For the House, and tomorrow's no different, and we'll see what happens.
Chris, I opened the show with that today in my initial monologue, and it's just two words, Chris, calm down. Everybody's got to calm down. You know, the people on the left are Democrats saying, well, democracy's at stake, and the people on the right are saying, well, we've got to stop the communists. No, Wednesday morning, Chris, 99.9% of the world's going to wake up, they're going to look at the results, and guess what? They're all going to go back to work or back to school. The world's not going to end here. But yet, there are people on both sides of the aisle that keep telling us.
You're right to a very large degree that if everything's going to be fine tomorrow. Are there important issues at stake? Absolutely. And I think what you hear from Democrats is that I think their party really hasn't paid attention too closely to local and state elections and maybe non-presidential elections. And this is why they might think we have, created this whole thing with Trump and the Trump party, and which has created all the, the Republican leaning Supreme Court, which led to Dobbs and all those other things. And they had kind of been asleep at the switch. So, in a way, I understand how Democrats are a little bit anxious about the fact that, they're trying to play catch up here at this point. Republicans have had a concerted strategy for the last couple of decades to really go after the local state elections and the judiciary and have been largely successful. And so, I get it on one hand, but yes, life goes on the other.
Dr. Chris Haynes is the guest. He's an associate professor of political science and legal studies at the University of New Haven, an expert on public opinion, voting, immigration, and all that. Chris, the public opinion thing, the polls and all these incessant polls. Now, some are bad, some are good, some are really good. I talk about this a lot with my guests. I love polls, but I know what they are. They're numbers. You got to look at the sampling. Who did it? What's their record? Is all this polling good for politics or not?
Wow, that's a really tough question there, right? polling, is it good for politics? Maybe it is. It drums up interest, right, in some ways. And so maybe that gets more people to vote, which is a good thing.
Because we love scoreboards, right? We love looking at the scoreboard, don't we?
We do love looking at scoreboards, but it does kind of turn into a horse race of sorts. And sometimes, it obscures some of the larger issues at play on local elections, and it's just about between Dems and Republicans and who's going to win. you know, it might trivialize it a little bit. It might kind of play into the whole kind of tribal narrative that we have going. So maybe the answer is yes and no to some extent. But I think anything that gets people to want to vote and to participate in the democracy is a good thing.
Yeah, maybe they see these statistical dead heats and they figure, I have to vote. You know, Chris, fascinating contest in this cycle, to me anyway, and maybe to you, is the Georgia Senate race and the role that abortion is playing here. And I think it's safe to say that most of the pro Herschel Walker people are pro-life. They want limits on choice for women, which is fine. They can vote that way. But all these revelations about one or two, or people are saying now three abortions that Herschel Walker may in the past have facilitated, doesn't seem to bother a lot of people, at least in his base, Chris. It's almost like we vote for the uniform now and not the people who are actually wearing it.
Yeah, this might partially be the legacy of Donald Trump, although I wouldn't want to attribute it completely to that, right? We have an economy and inflation levels that are, you know, not good for the ruling party, for the Democratic Party right now. And, you know, you have these historical trends where you see the out party typically gaining seats in the midterm election. And so, you know, I think they're all at play here in this election. You have a state of Georgia, which is, its DNA has typically been, at least for the last 20 years, pretty Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just reverting back to that old Republican DNA in a year where you'd expect Republicans to do well anyway, and you have inflation concerns that are weighing down the current party and the incumbent Democrats. So, you know, I wouldn't make too much of it, although, you know, obviously for people that believe in democracy, that would be concerning. You know, he is what we'd call a weak candidate or not a very high quality candidate. And surprising to see that he is now probably up in the polls and probably expected to win at this point over the Democratic incumbent Warnock.
I've been reading from people like James Carville, Stanley Greenberg, and Hillary Rosen said it, Chris, over the weekend on CNN, is that Democrats kind of became a little tone deaf. They're kind of skewering their own party, relying a little too much on abortion and not enough particularly on crime, with the GOP hammering the crime problem, mainly in the big cities. Thoughts on that? Because it sounds like they're starting early with the mea culpas here, a little bit. Who knows what happens tomorrow, but I found what Ms. Rosen said over the weekend particularly interesting.
Well, you know, it's not looking too good when the Democrats starting to fire upon each other. You know, the second point is, I think what had happened is when the Dobbs decision came out in the summer, you saw some movement towards the Democratic Party in the generic congressional vote. And it might have almost misled the Democrats into thinking, okay, this is our ticket to victory here. That's going to overcome the inflation and the economic woes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that seemed to be more of a blip in a sense, and there was a little bit more reversion to what was there before Dobbs. And so I think Democrats are now kind of caught almost, I don't want to say flat-footed, but with a strategy that didn't pan out. And now they are just scrambling. And for a lot of them, obviously, it's, I think, too late at this point. They bet on the wrong horse, I think.
And Chris, final question for you. We should mention you co-authored The Twitter Effect, How Trump Used Social Media to Stamp His Brand and Shape the Media Narrative on Immigration. And he did that also largely on his entire presidency. What are your thoughts now, looking at what's transpired? Crazy few days, Chris, with Twitter and Elon Musk. And now their former CEO saying, well, I may have grown the company a little too fast. Boy, I tell you, this whole Twitter thing, it's got people, like I said, Chris, they're freaking out. I'm like, calm down. But boy, it's become so interwoven now in our politics and the media landscape. What are your thoughts on what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the hard part is, I think Twitter played a big role. Of course, media played a big role in the rise of Trump. And I think what concerns a lot of, like, Democrats, big D, and maybe even little D Democrats, is the fact that, you know, these important tools and institutions like Twitter, right, that have the, you know, have the power to really kind of shape elections and make people and bring the rise of people like Trump, are in control are being controlled by one person or by being so consolidated, you know, people like Elon Musk. It may not necessarily be the fact that it's Elon Musk, but I think that should point out a fundamental problem that is happening in society. It's this consolidation of power into some people that are very wealthy. And that's something that I think we might need to reflect on moving forward. So, yeah, is it concerning? Yeah, I think it's concerning. Is it the end of the world? Probably not.
Thank you. You're like me. Everybody needs to calm down and take a walk and enjoy the sunset. Dr. Chris Haynes, Associate Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at the University of New Haven. Chris, thank you. We appreciate it. Hope to talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Dr. Chris Haynes there, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies, an expert on public opinion, voting, immigration, and he's co-authored a couple of books as well. See, like Chris said, calm down. Everything's going to be fine. People just have to deal with it. Listen, let's understand something here. It's not going to be Armageddon no matter what side wins. Okay, the American system is set up, all right? The American system is set up to take it slow or slowly. Is that the right word? I don't know. My grammar tends to improve as the show goes on. But you know what I mean. Oh, my God, the Republicans are going to control Congress. Well, there's not a whole lot they can do to actually pass laws. There's still going to be a Democrat in the White House for 2 years. Yeah, you can pass stuff in the Senate, but in the House, rather. But once you get to the Senate, you're going to need, you would need now, and who knows, the Democrats still may control the Senate, which means that you would still need probably 8 to 10 Republicans to agree on stuff. And what are the chances of that happening? And even if the Republicans somehow, it's about a 50-50 estimate now, 50-50 split, even if the Republicans regain control of the Senate, what are the odds that you're going to get, I don't know, depending upon what the gap is, 8, 10, 12 different Democrats to come along? So, and maybe it's the fault of my business, maybe it's the fault of the media in general, maybe it's the fault of the political pundits, but oh my God. Everybody's saying, oh, this is it. This is it. No, calm down. Because guess what? On Wednesday morning, everybody's going to get up. They're going to go outside. They're going to say, oh, geez, nothing really much has changed. There are safeguards in the system to make sure that happens. And you know, another thing, shame on every Democrat from President Biden on down, who is going out there over the past few days and just blatantly trying to scare people. I mean, blatantly trying to scare people. Well, you know, if they elect Republicans, these people are election deniers, and they're going to try and tear down the democracy. This is the big thing now. Democracy's at stake. Oh, relax. Democracy's not at stake. And you know what? Guess what? If you people on the Democratic side had done a better job, you should have waltzed to an easy reelection. And maybe you will tomorrow. I don't know. All the punditry, all the pregame shows, all these panel discussions, me sitting here, we may all be wrong. We might. We very, very well might. Nobody knows anything until the ballots are counted. But shame on the president, the vice president, the former presidents out there. All I heard over the weekend was Joe Biden getting up there. This isn't a referendum. It's a choice. No, and I know why he's saying that, because they told him to, because a focus group came up with this. Here's the bottom line, Mr. President. If your party had done a better job, top to bottom, you wouldn't have to worry about anything, now would you? And in fact, the party in charge of the White House, it's a historical fact, whether it's a Democrat or Republican administration, they always lose seats in the House. But my God, they're going out there like the barbarians are at the gates. Relax. You know what the problem is? The Democrats didn't give people, now we don't know what's going to happen. Maybe they will hold the House. But even you have Democratic strategists now, we've talked about this, who've come out and said, well, you know, we didn't give the people what they want. It was all abortion all the time. Well, hey, whose problem is that? And I mean, after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, all you heard, well, guess what? It's going to be a Roe-vember coming up. And a lot of people, including myself and a lot of pundits, said, well, not necessarily. Now, it might be. Who knows? But they're already, if you read this stuff that's been published on Saturday and Sunday and into this morning, it's, oh, my God, you would think that the world is going to end. Relax. That is irresponsible. That is irresponsible. I'm just telling you. Now, again, nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow night into the wee hours of Wednesday morning, how long it'll take, this thing to be counted out. But I have an idea. When a party doesn't do enough of what people want, they're going to lose. And the other party will win. And then if that other party sucks for 2 years, the other party will win again. It's the wonderful pendulum of American politics. And it tends to work. I know a lot of people on the left and the right grouse about it. But you know what? It actually tends to work if you sit back, relax, and look at it. And another thing, I saw these pundits over the weekend, you know, soaking in as much as I could for this show. These pundits, well, you know, the Republicans are better than the Democrats on crime. And is that really fair? Oh, is that really fair? I don't know. Look at this story. Strap hanger stabbed in the neck on a subway platform after an argument with other riders. And the person that did the stabbing, the suspect, 24 prior arrests. Another story. Homeless man and a serial rapist busted for an attack in the West Village in New York. A serial rapist. 25 prior attacks. But wait a minute. It's the Republicans' fault for ginning up fear about crime? Come on. Come on. And even Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, boy, where do you see this playing out? And for a lot of you folks in Fairfield County, listen to me right now, they go into the city every day. Did you see Kathy Hochul the other day? She was on with an interviewer on MSNBC. And this interviewer on MSNBC said, Governor, you know, I'm afraid to go to the pharmacy around my block in Manhattan. So even the left of center outlets now are saying, yeah, crime is pretty bad. But remember, if crime turns out to be the deciding factor, oh, it's going to be the Republicans' fault. No, it's your fault, because you let people like the two I just talked to you about in New York, one person with 24 prior arrests and one person with 25 prior arrests, you let them back on the street. That's nonpartisan idiocy right there. We've had this gentleman on the program before a few times. The name of his group is AmericanCommitment.org. So check that out, AmericanCommitment.org. And Phil Kirpin is the guest, and Phil has some thoughts this time around on the president's proposal for student loan forgiveness. Hey, Phil, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Paul. How are you?
Good, Phil. Have you stocked up on your adult beverages, your popcorn, and your pork rinds for tomorrow night? Are you all set for election night?
I've got a lot of snacks and whatnot. I'm hoping it'll be one of those nights where I end up staying up all night celebrating. conservative win after conservative win.
Pouring bottles of
kind of election night.
Pouring bottles of champagne.
You know, the other kind is not as much fun.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. I'm not sure how much of the red wave is going to reach Connecticut, unfortunately. I think the 5th district looks pretty good, but the statewide race, I'm not so sure.
Who knows?
In a wave, anything can happen.
Yeah, that's it, Phil, and we're going to see that. And one issue I know that's been bandied about, and you've talked about this, you want to get some words in about it now, is the proposal by President Biden to forgive $10,000 of federal guaranteed student loan debt, up to $20,000 if you have a Pell Grant involved, I think. So it's 10 or 20, depending upon the limits of the household income. Amy Coney Barrett, the Supreme Court Justice, she, I think, Phil, it was yesterday, the day before, she, or late last week, she did not stand in the way of this, so it has survived another test here. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the Barrett not taking emergency action on the two cases arising out of the Seventh Circuit is kind of deceptive headlines. It's kind of misdirection, I think, by the press that they're acting like that's a big deal, because this whole thing is on hold by the Eighth Circuit. There's a stay on the whole thing. The president cannot discharge loans while the Eighth Circuit is considering an appeal. And so it actually would have been pretty surprising if the Supreme Court did anything, because there's no emergency from the standpoint of a plaintiff trying to stop this from happening, because it can't happen unless the Eighth Circuit lifts that stay. Interestingly, if the Eighth Circuit does lift the stay and they don't grant an injunction, the emergency appeal would go to Kavanaugh. He's the designated justice for that circuit. And so I think the case to watch is really the one out of the Eighth Circuit. And, they put the stay on October 21st. And so we're coming up on a month.
Yeah.
We're 2 weeks. We're on 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks from when they put that stay on. I could be crazy, but I think if you were just going to agree with the district court and dismiss the case, it wouldn't take you this long to do it. So I'm getting cautiously more optimistic by the day with how long they're taking. That they actually are going to grant the injunction to stop this thing. We've never before in American history had a president announce that he was going to attempt to spend, $400 or $500 billion essentially on his own without an authorization or appropriation from Congress. It offends the most fundamental principle of our constitutional system. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that the courts will stop it. That said, the case in the Eighth Circuit actually turns on kind of a tricky factual question, which is, is the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority a part of the state of Missouri, such that the Attorney General can sue on their behalf? Because, the whole problem with stopping this thing has been figuring out who has standing to sue, who's actually injured by it in a way that the courts will recognize so they can bring the lawsuit. None of the student loan servicing companies want to sue, though, because, they don't want to be frozen out of the next round of contracts.
Well, of course.
Be with the same administration. And, right? So they set all the contracts to expire at the end of next year. They know what they're doing. They did it on purpose. So none of them want to sue. But, as it turns out, two of the nine federal servicing companies are actually agencies of states, one in Oklahoma and one in Missouri. We haven't been able to convince either of those agencies to file a suit under their own name, but in Missouri what happened is the Attorney General said, I'm the Attorney General. This is an instrumentality of the state that was created by state law. The board is appointed by the governor. This is part of the state government. I can sue as the Attorney General of the state. And the district court judge disagreed. He said, you can't. And that's actually what they're considering on appeal right now. And I think the appeal is very strong, having read the briefs. I mean, it looks like a state agency to me. And so we'll see. But that's actually what this could turn on, as odd as it is.
The name of the group is American Commitment. To go to the website, AmericanCommitment.org. We've had their president, Phil Kirpin, on a few times, a few more minutes with Phil. Phil, do me a favor, backtrack a little bit on this and explain to folks what the controversy is here. And I know you got deeply into it, but the notion of what powers the president might have to actually forgive this student loan, the 10 or 20 grand's a student loan, 10 or 20 grand, I'm sorry, worth of student loan debt for certain borrowers who fit within income guidelines. What is the debate here of what a president can do? and or what should be done by Congress, and also the fact that a lot of the argument here is around a 2001 law. So break it down for us.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a year ago, even Nancy Pelosi was saying, you know, of course the president can't forgive student loans, only Congress could do that. That's, you know, an appropriation of funds. And, you know, she's changed her tune when the president announced he was doing it anyway. But what they're trying to do is, it's actually a 2003 law, but it was part of the response to 9/11, which is probably why you're thinking 2001. But
yeah,
they've got a law that's called the HEROES Act. And the idea behind it was basically, you know, if you've got a national emergency, and they were, of course, thinking of terrorism at the time, of a terror attack or something in the war on terror, and you have a foreign maybe deployment maybe and something like that, that the Secretary of Education would have the authority to modify loans so that people are not harmed financially by their participation in fighting that national emergency. And the idea behind it was, look, if somebody's a first responder or they're in the military and they're not going to be able to make their loan payments because they got called up to active duty at a lower rate of pay than what they were making in the private sector, or whatever the circumstance might have been, the secretary could look at that and say, you know, based on these factors, I'm going to give you forbearance of this amount or modify your loan terms so that you're made whole by what occurred to you in that emergency. And what Biden is saying is, well, the words emergency are in here, and, you know, COVID's an emergency, so I'm just going to make up out of whole cloth a brand-new program for 40 million borrowers, and I'm going to, you know, they're all just going to get the same $10,000 or $20,000,
yeah,
and I'm just going to make up income limits. And there isn't even any attempt to tie the amount that he's giving to the harms that people actually suffered during COVID, which is what the statute itself would actually call for if you were trying to honestly apply it. So it's really far afield from what Congress was considering when it passed that law. And I think what's really most outrageous about the legal analysis from the Biden administration is they completely ignore a very recent Supreme Court decision in West Virginia versus EPA, when the Supreme Court said, you know, on major questions, and I think spending $500 billion would qualify but for by anyone's definition, the Supreme Court said on major questions, Congress needs to specifically direct the executive branch to do something. An agency can't just grab old laws off a shelf and fashion them into a new program. That decision was just handed down this year. And this is, you know, exactly what the Biden administration is attempting to do, which is why I think, you know, if somebody survives the standing analysis, this program will probably be stopped. But that's also why, Paul, they've got their finger on the button. So if a stay is lifted, they're going to press it and get as much money out the door as they can before they can be stopped.
What's your gut feeling, Phil, in about the minute we have left? I know you went over some of the legal precedents before and some things that have happened, but does your gut tell you the courts are going to want to stay out of the way of this, or could there really be a kibosh on this? Maybe not end it in this phase, but just say, okay, we're not against this, but it's got to go through Congress.
Yeah, I don't think the president's going to get away with doing this on his own steam. I think that the courts are going to stop it. And as I said, I'm increasingly optimistic with each passing day that that's exactly what the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is working on writing. I tend to think that if they were going to side with the district court and dismiss the case, they would have done it more quickly. You know, maybe they're waiting for the election or something. Who knows? But I do think there's a good chance the court stops it. But look, this is a real issue. Student debt's a real issue. I do think that Congress should address it. They should do it the right way. And I think that they should use it to get at the real heart of the problem, which is the all of the incentives right now point towards higher and higher and higher tuition.
Thank
and if you.
You
discharge a bunch of loans, that's going to make it worse.
Thank you, Phil. Nobody wants – Phil, I was railing on this when this story came out. Why the hell is college so expensive? It's ridiculous, Phil. But nobody wants – Phil, nobody – shh, don't ask that in front of Congress, Phil. Don't ask that.
Well, what I would do if I were in charge of Congress, what I would do on this issue is I would say, you know what, we're going to make it much easier to discharge student loans in bankruptcy. You know, you're going to have to put a 7 or 10 year waiting period,
yeah,
after college so people don't just, you know, bankruptcy at the beginning of their working life. But after a waiting period, I would make it so you can discharge student loans in bankruptcy, but with one huge twist. I would make the college responsible for the discharge loan.
Oh, boy.
And align their incentive
yeah.
to make sure that people are actually going to be able to earn enough of a living to pay back their loan so it doesn't fall back on them.
Yeah, maybe those endowments might be worth something. Phil Kirpin, thank you, Phil. He heads American Commitment. Check it out, folks, online, AmericanCommitment.org. Phil, good to hear from you again. We'll talk down the road, my friend. Thank you.
Have a good one.
All right. Phil Kirpin, K-E-R-P-N. His group is called AmericanCommitment.org. So he thinks, ready for this? He thinks that the reason we haven't heard from this federal court, even though, like he said, we did hear something from Amy Coney Barrett the other day, he thinks that the court's going to tell the White House, you can't do this.